Welcome to the Filmmaker Mixer Podcast, the podcast by filmmakers for filmmakers. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined alongside my co-host Jeff, as always. Jeff and I are writers and directors and passionate about the art of storytelling. Filmmaker Mixer is a creative hub where aspiring and established filmmakers come together to share experiences, insights, strategies, and inspiration. Today, we have on the show George Stevens Jr.
Hello, everybody. This is the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, and we've got an amazing show for you today. We are chatting with George Stevens Jr. He's got a new book out called My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington. George is a producer, director, creator of the American Film Institute. So we have lots of questions for you, sir. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here and look forward to a lively conversation.
Well, we will do our best. You know, one of the things I'm curious about, you obviously have generations of people in your family who've been in show business, and you were surrounded by it as you were growing up as a kid. But I'm curious, was there a defining moment when you decided you had to be a storyteller and a filmmaker, and then also when that had to become a career for you? Was there a moment when that happened, or was it sort of a gradual process?
It was kind of gradual. I was in high school. I was the editor, the sports editor of the paper, and then the editor of the paper, and then the editor of the annual, you know, the graduate of the yearbook. So I was drawn to the creative process, and I was around my father and mother, who lived in a creative world. So it wasn't that I wanted to be a sports writer.
Oh, interesting.
There was a writer called Red Smith, who wrote for the New York Times, and my father used to read to me. There was Grantland Rice was the one of the great sports writers of all time. And he'd read me Grantland Rice's articles. I quote in the book, and I don't have it here to quote from right now, but about how he described the Notre Dame backfield, the four horsemen, Leyden, Struhlderer, something and something, but very poetic. So, and then when I, in college, I was sort of in the speech department.
And what college were you at?
I went to Occidental College, mm-hmm. and I then went in the Air Force and was a motion picture officer.
Oh, interesting.
So I just kind of gradually got into it, and it just became what I did.
Well, I'm also curious because I remember when I was going to film school at University of Texas with my good friend Merle Bertrand, who ended up writing for Film Threat for many years. When we were in film school, one of the required screenings at the theater was Shane. And great picture. And if I understand correctly, and tell me if I'm wrong, you found that story and presented it to your dad. Is that how that started? Tell us about that.
My father was away at war for 3 years. We're going to jump in here in the middle. He headed combat photography in the war in Europe. And he went in on D-Day with his camera, about a 40-man camera team. And he rode in a Jeep from Normandy to Dachau.
Oh, wow.
With a rifle between his legs, you know. So he really had a war. And the film they shot is the record of that, the battles of World War II. And in I've made two films about it. One, George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey, is the biography I made of my father, a feature-length film. But the centerpiece of it is the war in Europe with the color film that he shot. They were shooting 35 millimeter black and white to send back to America, where we saw it in theaters on newsreels.
Right.
But he had 16 millimeter film, and he shot about 3 hours. That I used that film in that film and made another film called George Stevens D-Day to Berlin. Actually, both of these are on Max, which is the story of his unit that was called the Stevens Irregulars. A year after he came back, I graduated from high school and I didn't have a job. And he said, well, maybe you can help me. His assignment was first to break down Theodore Dreiser's great novel, An American Tragedy.
Oh, interesting.
Father was about to make a film based on an American tragedy that became A Place in the Sun with Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor and Shelley Winters, for which he won his first Oscar.
Right.
And my other job was to read things that came from the studio. Dad had offices in North Hollywood, and he was at Paramount Pictures in Hollywood. And they'd send over books and scripts, and a lot of it was pretty tedious reading for a 17-year-old. Bucolic love stories. And one afternoon, a book came, and I picked it up. It was a small book, and I read it in the afternoon. And that night, I went over. My father was in bed reading, and I walked in, and I said, "Dad, I said, I read this book. I think it's really a good story. I think you ought to read it." And he looked over at me. He said, "Well, why don't you tell me the story?" So I found myself pacing around his bed, trying to recall the details to tell him the story of Jack Schaefer's novel, Shane.
This is your first pitch.
Yeah, my first pitch, exactly. And it earned me my first job the next summer in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I had a job called company clerk, and I was right next to the camera with a clipboard. And I just had this graduate course in filmmaking. Nobody knew, or maybe he knew, that he was making a film that would stand the test of time. And it was just this wonderful learning experience. And beside that, I had a horse saddled up every morning with a rain slicker on the back. And sometimes on our lunch breaks, I'd take off on my horse and ride up, near the Teton Mountains. And just to keep us way out of sequence here, you'd started with my grandparents, and we're already to this past December. I gave my father's papers long ago to the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences, and they started something called the George Stevens Lecture.
Oh,
It was
interesting.
from 1982. Robert Benton did the first one, talking about A Place in the Sun. But then it was suspended during COVID for obvious reasons. And in last year, we were bringing it back, and I wanted it to come back, in a dramatic and, way that attracted attention. And so on December 10th, in the new museum, the Academy Museum, this great theater they have, the Geffen Theater, with a 30-foot high screen, we showed Shane
Oh, wow.
on its 70th anniversary.
Nice.
And Christopher Nolan did the George Stevens lecture
Wow.
leading the film, because he had been influenced by Shane. And my grandson, who saw Shane for the first time that night, said, "Well, the ending comes from The Dark Knight," or it's really vice versa. But Nolan spoke of being influenced, and he was influenced by the treatment of evil in Shane, the Jack Palance character, and that actually the head rancher even makes a case, a real case, for why that land they feel belongs to them. That it was more than good guys and bad guys. It had some what he called the ethical framework of the film. So yes, and Giant is a film that has stood the test of time. Keeping out of sequence, since
Sure, go for it.
the way I introduced Christopher Nolan in speaking about my father, was I spoke told of going to the Academy Awards in 1952 with my father. He drove the car. His actress mother was in the back seat, and my former actress mother was in the back seat, and I sat next to him, and in the theater. And Joseph L. Mankiewicz came on the stage. He had won the Oscar for directing the year before for All About Eve, and he read the nominees: John Huston for African Queen, William Wyler for Detective Story, Vincent Minnelli for An American in Paris, Elia Kazan for A Streetcar Named Desire, George Stevens for A Place in the Sun. Well, I wouldn't be telling this story if John Huston had won for African Queen. My father won. But riding home that night in the car, he was driving the car. The Oscar was on the seat between us. And he looked over at me, and I don't know why. He said, you know, he said, we'll have a better idea what kind of a film this is in about 25 years.
Interesting.
Yeah. This is on the night, you know, when everybody's out getting drunk with their Oscars.
Right.
He had that thought that he understood this idea of the test of time.
Right.
Well, he didn't know that the 18-year-old sitting next to him would one day be the founder of the American Film Institute, which is really based on the test of time.
Right.
Films that last, preserving the films, training people to make films that will stand the test of time. You know, that was obviously a great influence in my life because I had this framework of thinking of appraising films and appreciating the ones that stood the test of time. Now I turn it back to you and you can
reorganize. I do have a quick follow-up, like just staying on the inspiration of Shane and everything, because one of my more, I guess, surprise favorite movies that's come out recently, I didn't know I'd like as much, was Logan by James Mangold, which directly quotes Shane and actually shows a movie clip of Shane in the movie. I'm curious, like, how aware you were, you know, that they were going to do that, if it was a surprise to you, you know.
That was a surprise. Yeah. Although James was a fellow at the American Film Institute at the conservatory that we established in 1969. So I was very pleased by that. And James Mangold did a George Stevens lecture about Shane.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
So your connection is right, Andrew.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, so one of the things Jeff and I talk about a lot when it comes to being a filmmaker is finding your voice. Your father obviously was a very successful director. I'm sure, you know, he had influence on you as a director, but I'm curious, when did you start discovering your own voice, and how did you find your own voice?
Well, that's interesting, and I'm not sure. When I got out of the Air Force, I worked for Jack Webb, who made Dragnet. And Jack was a big influence, gave me my first opportunity to direct a pilot for him, for his Mark 7 Limited company. And that led to me when I was 26 and 7, directing Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Peter Gunn. And I don't think that was finding my own voice. That was somebody else's voice, but good voices. And then I worked with my father on The Diary of Anne Frank.
Oh, wow.
And I could tell you a little about that at some point if you wish.
Sure.
And then just skipping ahead, then the big change in my life was Edward R. Murrow, the great broadcaster who did the CBS News and wonderful programs, documentaries on CBS. President Kennedy appointed him to head the United States Information Agency, which is the government agency that told America's story abroad with films, The Voice of America. And Ed Murrow asked me at age 29 to come back and run the motion picture division of USIA, where our job was to make 300 documentaries a year, which meant I had to find people to make these documentaries and decide what documentaries we were going to make. And I would say that's when I started to find my own voice, because I was looking for projects and choosing projects and thinking of projects that would tell America's story in a way we liked it told. And happily, they refer to that era at USIA as the golden age of USIA films. So that was, I think, when I, and I was very influenced by President Kennedy, who said, you know, I look forward to an America that will not be afraid of grace and beauty, that will reward achievement in the arts the way we reward achievement in business or statescraft. And that was a big influence on me.
Well, I want to circle back to the craft of filmmaking just for a second. You know, Andrew was asking how you develop your voice. Yeah. I'm also curious. I know you worked with Sidney Poitier on the miniseries Separate But Equal. Right. And it makes me wonder, when you're working with these iconic actors, as they become iconic actors, you know, they have big personalities and a big presence. And right. I'm sure each of them has a different way into a scene, a different way in on how they approach the craft of acting. So I'm curious, as a director, how do you balance working with one style of actor versus another style of actor? Does that affect your approach in directing a scene and putting a scene together? Or does that question even make sense?
Oh, it does. It makes a great deal of sense. I, having watched my father on Shane and Giant and on The Diary of Anne Frank, and I ended up directing all the location scenes in Amsterdam on The Diary of Anne Frank, he had enough confidence in me that he turned that over to me. But I've found that in watching him, and that the first job is to make the actor comfortable.
Right, right.
And you know, he never raised his voice. I never raised my voice on a set, you know, except you have to make something happen. But certainly in talking with actors, you want to make them comfortable so they can bring to it what you want. An illustrative experience was, I visited him on the set of A Place in the Sun. It was one of my first times as an adult on a set. And he was shooting a scene with Elizabeth Taylor on Montgomery Cliff. And and they came in, and you know, in the morning, it was a new scene. They were just getting started on it. And he said to Monty, he said, well, why don't you go in there? Why don't you find a place right by the pool table? You know, and then Elizabeth, why don't you start at the door? And then, you know, you come in and we'll let the scene play. And so he went over, and he's got everybody standing back, the crew waiting to come in and do the lighting and all. And then Elizabeth walks in, and they play the scene, and the script a girl is there, as we call them then, to give cues, because it's their first time, helping them with the lines and all of that. And they finished, and he said, oh, that's nice. He said, why don't we just do it one more time here? And they went, and they did it. And he said, okay, well, let's do this again. And he said, okay, and I think, you know. And so they did it again, you know. And then after that, Monty came rushing over to him, you know, and kind of took him aside and asking him questions. And Liz noticed that, so she came over too. And all of a sudden, you know, and anyway, then they went back and they rehearsed the scene some more and refined it and made some changes and fixes. And then he said, okay, go ahead and light the scene and all of that. And then he came over and we were talking. And I said, Dad, I said, why did you do it three times without giving any? He says, sometimes it's helpful for the actors to know that they may need some help. You know, rather than coming in and saying, well, I want you to do it this way. And they say, well, I think I might want to do it that way. But once they realize, you know, so I think that's a very good cue for when you think about directing actors, is to make them comfortable. And then, they, when I directed Sidney, he was a great star. I was younger than he, although I was in my 50s, because I'd done the AFI and I'd not been directing.
Right.
And Burt Lancaster was also, having two of those stars. But again, I just found that my way of doing it, you know, worked for them. You know, obviously you respect them, and Burt was having trouble remembering his lines at that stage. And I found all sorts of ways to be helpful to him in that. And, usually, I'll just tell you a little story that Jack Lemmon, who I also
Oh.
directed, Jack came out. This is when he came out to Hollywood from Broadway, where he'd been doing some great work. He worked with George Cukor, and I forget the name of the film, but Jack would do the scene, and George would say, "Well, good, Jack." He said, "Just do it a little less. Just do it a little less," and then he'd do it again, and three times, a little less, a little less. And the last time, Jack said, "Well, if you do more of that, I won't be acting." And Cukor said, "Exactly."
Oh, funny.
You know, that too. And there's a variations on a kind of a similar thing that often with actors, I was about to say that with, Bert, if he's doing too much or, and you like that because you want to know what the range is, but sometimes you just want to take it down a little bit, a little more natural. Or sometimes you maybe want them to do more, but.
I'm curious too. We've talked a lot about movies, but I'd love to talk a little bit about AFI. What led you to wanting to start it, and what the initial idea was to maybe make it unique, set it apart from other film schools?
Working with President Kennedy, he was wonderful with quotations, his speeches, and he loved history, and he quoted the ancient Greeks, and that one was the Greek definition of happiness, which is the fullest use of one's powers along lines of excellence. And here I was working under Ed Murrow and President Kennedy, making 300 documentaries a year. And I realized that I had the definition of Greek happiness. I was doing something I loved and aspiring to make excellent films, and very often we did. And it was during President Kennedy that he was an advocate for the arts. And the machinery was put in motion, the legislation for the National Endowment for the Arts. And the AFI grew out of the National Endowment for the Arts, the first funding for the arts in American history. And having been in government, realizing how government could be used to advantage, and realizing so much more could be done for film, I proposed an American Film Institute to the National Council on the Arts. And they liked the idea. And somehow Lyndon Johnson, in one of the reports, read about it. And when he signed the legislation for the National Endowment for the Arts, he said, "We'll start a national opera, we'll deal with symphony orchestras, and we will create an American Film Institute," which shocked me. But once it was Johnson's idea, it was going to happen. And I was asked if I would head it. And I it was a big decision for me because I'd moved from Hollywood to Washington. And my intention was to go back to Hollywood and continue my career. But I had also gotten married, and a wonderful Elizabeth, my wife of 56 years or whatever it is now. And we agreed that it was after President Kennedy's death, but we were close with Bob Kennedy, and this idea of excellence appealed to us, and to remain part of that world while also part of the Hollywood world. So I agreed to start the Film Institute. And one of the ideas was, I felt what was needed was a conservatory, a bridge between film school and the profession. And so we set up what we called at first the AFI Center for Advanced Film Studies, that is now known as the AFI Conservatory.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard in one of your interviews that you wanted AFI to be more focused on voice and story and less on, gear and mechanics and things like that. Is that correct or am I wrong?
That is true. That the conservatory, that storytelling, you know, but the heart of filmmaking, and that really is and continues to be the core of what is taught at the AFI Conservatory. Though there are cinematographers and production designers, but everybody starts at that point of how do you engage an audience.
Well, staying on story, Andrew and I just covered the Austin Film Festival, which is a very, you know, writer-centric festival. And, you know, I'm here in Austin, Texas, so my mother-in-law would be upset if I didn't ask you about Giant. And I know that, you know, I think it was Ivan Moffat and Fred Gill. Okay, I got it in my notes. We're on that story. And you were there with the, I don't know if you were in the room. I think you were connected somehow around
the room. I graduated from Occidental.
That must have been like a instant film school, writing school.
I was supposed to go in the Air Force, and the Korean War ended, and they didn't want me for a year, so they postponed it. At that time, my father had just acquired Edna Ferber's novel and made a deal with Jack Warner to make Giant, and he was to start on the screenplay. So every morning at 9:30, Ivan Moffat, Fred Gill, compadre of my father's from the Hal Roach days, who he was a big man of Mexican descent and kind of talk, mumbled, but he had a real story sense. And Ivan Moffat was an articulate Englishman, younger. And my father and I, the four of us, would sit there every morning at 9:30 and start with page one. And by the time I had to go in the Air Force, there was a first draft screenplay. And in answer to your question, yes, just to have sat there and to see how you wrestle something like that into a screenplay. And it just, you know, and it doesn't happen quickly, you know, because it's artistic, but it's also kind of scientific. You have to figure out the structure and how you combine characters or eliminate characters, or, you know. And we wrote a screenplay, and we knew the studio was going to be concerned because the screenplay was long. We had a woman who'd come over from Warner Brothers to type it, and we kept having her make wider margins so it would be fewer pages. And when Jack Warner read the script, which he liked a lot, but he said, George, he said, this script is 200 whatever pages. And he said, it feels like a 2.5 hour movie to me. And I've really found that 2 hours is the best length for movies. And my father kind of talked him aside on it. And he said, even in Battle Cry, I got restless at 2.5 hours. And Dad says, I get restless in 2 hour movies. And the budget then was $2.5 million. So Jack Warner ended up with a 3-hour and 20-minute movie that cost $5 million. But it was the most successful picture that Warner's ever had to that time.
Is that right? Interesting.
Yeah. And it lives today. I mean, it's stands the test of time like few others. In fact, your mother-in-law may agree that Giant really becomes more current, or is so current with today, with the independent strong woman at the center of the story, the problem of dealing with the Hispanics who were mistreated. We're talking about that today.
Well, I did have another question. I know Andrew wants to talk about the book, but I just have one quick follow-up in talking about Giant and some of these other big films. You were surrounded by so many iconic actors and filmmakers, yeah. You know, James Dean and Elizabeth Taylor. I'm curious, did any of those people, you know, not including your father, did any of those people impact your life in a way that maybe changed how you viewed your career, your future career?
If those actors had, you would be talking to an Oscar-winning actor right now. No, I was influenced by Fred Zinnemann, whom I knew, William Wyler, John Huston. They were the ones, David Lean,
Oh, wow.
you know, that I often quote David Lean. He was in a bookstore in London, you know, kind of looking for books, and he backed into somebody. And he turned around, and it was Carol Reed, the great director,
Right.
British director. And they were both there looking for stories. But David said, the hardest part of making a movie is finding a story you fall in love with.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, and before we let you go, I just wanted to touch on something Jeff had mentioned at the top of the show, which is your book, My Place in the Sun: Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood in Washington. I know it's been out for a little bit, but our producer Melody loved the book. I think she read it front to back in like a day or two or something, and she highly recommends it. But I'm curious from you, if you could tell us a little bit more about the book, where people could get it, all that stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, the book, My Place in the Sun, is a title that I came to after I'd written it. But obviously, it's a variation on my father's movie, A Place in the Sun, and Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood, which I lived, you know, from the time I was born when my father was the cameraman for Laurel and Hardy, on through having a we had a projector at home, and these 16-millimeter prints would come, and at 12 running Gunga Din. I don't know if you guys have seen Gunga Din. If you haven't, it is there would be no Indiana Jones without Gunga Din, with Cary Grant and Victor McLaughlin and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Sam Jaffe as the water boy, the regimental beastie named Gunga Din. But it's combat and humor and heart. And that, by the way, influenced me. And so I tell the story really of starting with my great grandmother was an actress in San Francisco in the stage, long before movies, named Georgia Woodthorpe. And she is famous, or one of her credentials is she was the youngest Ophelia to Edwin Booth's Hamlet, Edwin Booth being the greatest Hamlet in American history,
Right.
still, I believe. And then her daughter, Georgie Cooper, is my father's mother, married to Lander Stevens. Three of my grandparents were actors. My mother's Alice Howell, her mother was a made 100 silent comedies, and the first four of which she made with Charlie Chaplin. So I
Oh,
came
wow.
from this kind of background, but I was not very conscious of it growing up. And when I was in the Air Force and sports writing and all of that, but in getting down to write this book to have. They realize that this influence and this continuity through generations, and then in the book I do talk about, you know, growing up in Hollywood. After that scene in A Place in the Sun where Dad rehearsed Elizabeth and Monty, I was a freshman at Occidental. I was 17, and Elizabeth was 17, and you know, just the sight of her. You know, I saw her walk in and I was introduced to her. I mean, clearly the most beautiful woman on the planet. Shortly after the story I told you, she came up to me and she said, "Would you like to go have lunch?" And so I found myself walking down the street of the Paramount Studio with the most beautiful woman in the world and going into the commissary and having everybody look at us as we walk into a corner table. And we had hamburgers and chocolate milkshakes. There are stories after stories, and I think partly what Melody must like about the book is they're told rather efficiently, so you keep going on to the next one, and it takes you through a lot of American history, because in Washington I worked with seven presidents. I started the Kennedy Center Honors. And produced that for 37 years, worked with first Jimmy Carter, having worked with President Kennedy, and then the two Bushes and Clinton and Obama, and about being very involved in Barack Obama's campaign. And then about my own work, making A Filmmaker's Journey, and Separate But Equal with Sidney Poitier, which you brought up, is the story of Brown versus the Board of Education, in which Earl Warren led the Supreme Court to a 9-0. Think of the division today, that Earl Warren was able to lead a court to a 9-0 decision, because he thought a 9-0 decision was an important signal for the country. And this decision that ended segregation in public schools in the United States. And Sidney plays Thurgood Marshall, who led that case, and before in the South, and then to the Supreme Court. And Burt Lancaster plays the great John W. Davis, America's greatest lawyer, who Thurgood faced off with before the Supreme Court. And I expand on it because this is the 70th anniversary of the Brown decision.
Oh, yeah.
And Turner Classic Movies on May the 21st is going to show Separate But Equal on Turner Classic Movies.
And nice.
I don't think they've ever shown television, but this is going to be a unique thing and an opportunity for people to see this story. And it's going to be distributed elsewhere and on DVD again. And in any event, that's a rambling answer to any question. But at the heart of it, it is this idea of President Kennedy's feeling about the arts, that film at its best is an art and aspires to my greatest lesson from working with my father was respect for the audience. The studios in those days used to say, some still say, that the audience has the mentality of 14-year-olds, talk down to them. My father always respected the audience and said they have something to bring to the film. Leave something for them to do, for their ideas. So that idea about film and its place in our society is also a big part of the book.
Well, very
and
good.
Also,
well,
I should say,
sure.
I recorded the audio version, so you can get it on Spotify.
Oh, nice.
Buy it on Amazon or bookstores, wherever you buy books. It's called My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington.
Well, it's a great book. You've got tremendous stories, and we sure appreciate you sharing many of those stories with us today. I'd love to have you back on the show again sometime and chat more about movies, because you got great stories and great insight.
Let's do it. We'll do it again sometime.
All right. In the meantime, you take care, sir, and we will talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, a podcast created and hosted by filmmakers Jeff Stolen and Andrew Lamping, and produced by Melody Lopez.
Our theme song was composed by Stephen D. Bennett.
Make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on, and stay tuned for future episodes.